Welcome to On Air, a podcast by Fembla. We host bi-weekly discussions with inspiring founders and professionals from all around the world to talk about their journey, aspirations, and the power of connection. My name is Clara, and I'm the co-founder of Fembla, a career development platform for women. Our today's guest is Julia Hackspiel. Julia is an expert in market systems development and trade with a focus on gender and women's economic empowerment. She works as a senior specialist at MarketShare Associates, a global firm which believes that both public and private institutions should contribute to social transformation. Julia's passion for women's economic empowerment was so strong that she decided to leave Europe and move to Africa. By now, she has been living in Kenya for almost 6 years. There, she co-founded Sauti, an award-winning social enterprise that disseminates trade and market information to East African SMEs using mobile technology. What challenges did Julia face when moving to Kenya? What issues do women in Africa have, and how exactly does Sauti help them? How were the beginnings of her social impact business, and how did she manage to find investors? Listen to our episode and you will find out all the answers and much more. Hey Julia, welcome to our Fembla podcast.
Hi Clara, thank you for having me. It's a pleasure to be here.
Julia, I want to dive straight into it, and I would like to ask you, when you were a kid, what did you want to do when you grew up?
So I wanted to be a journalist. I've always been really interested in writing and storytelling, and I think in my mind, I glamorized it quite a bit. I guess I saw it as this very exciting life of adventure and travel, and that really inspired me. I've always enjoyed traveling and seeing new places.
Did you somehow pursue your career as a journalist or a writer?
A bit, definitely. In university, I was on the student newspaper. I was an editor of the international news section, which was really fun. But I think one thing I realized as a journalist is that I would really struggle to be impartial. I have strong opinions on most topics. Being neutral as a journalist, I think, would be very challenging. And at the same time, I sort of started learning about development. And I think that just like a career more in line with what I wanted to do with my life. But I definitely enjoyed my time on the student newspaper and got to work with some amazing people who are now in the media industry.
Great. So you didn't cut the ties, really. So just to sum up, you are originally from Poland. You graduated from development studies at the London School of Economics, and you work in development till this day. Now you're based in Kenya. Can you please tell me more about the journey? How did you know what you want to do already at college?
Yeah, so prior to going to university, on my undergrad, I studied politics and economics. I didn't really know very much about the development sector. Obviously, I had seen things like on the news, you know, about humanitarian crisis and the aid response. But it was in my undergrad, I got to take a few courses on international development, and it just really inspired me. I found it so fascinating. I think I was attracted to it, you know, for both quite selfless and selfish reasons. I definitely wanted to have an impact with my work and improve the lives of others. I always knew I didn't want sort of a standard office kind of job, but seeing poverty and like human suffering on TV always really affected me. So I knew I wanted to do something about it, but I also saw working in development as really an opportunity to, you know, travel and see the world and learn about so many different new cultures and countries. And intellectually, I found all the courses I took on development and university just so stimulating. You're kind of always presented with a new challenge and, you know, trying to solve it from different angles using economics, political science, social science. And I've always been a very curious person. So I think I love learning about new topics, and working in development has really allowed me to do that. I think every 3 months I'm learning about something new, you know, housing, women's empowerment, childcare services, refugees. And it's so exciting and fun to get to do that.
Sounds like a very fulfilling job, that you have a true passion for that. So what happened after the university? What in the end brought you to Kenya?
So after university, I stayed in London for a bit, and I had been working in the development sector for about 2 years for different development consulting firms. But I was becoming quite frustrated that, you know, I would be writing project proposals for countries that I had never even visited. And I knew that living in East Africa would allow me to really deepen my understanding of the region in a way that no amount of reading of academic papers or books or policy briefs ever would. And I guess I was also a bit of tired of London. I know you're not supposed to say that, but I was, and I was ready for a new adventure. My partner and I were long distance at the time. He was working with refugees in Ecuador, and Kenya just sort of made sense for us as a place to relocate together and kind of, you know, start the next chapter in our career.
Wow. And how long have you two been living there?
5 years. Yeah, 5.5 years. So it's been quite a while. We definitely never expected to stay this long. I think we initially thought we'd stay like 2 or 3 years, but yeah, it's been our home.
Oh my God, that's a long time. That's definitely your home. Let's talk more about your future plans later on, including, you know, whether or not you would like to stay in Kenya. But I would like to talk about the present. So what are you working on right now?
So I work for a company called MarketShare Associates. It's a development consulting firm that works with different clients such as IFC, World Bank, USAID, DFID on designing and implementing development programs all over the world. And a big focus of my work personally is gender and women's economic empowerment. It's something I'm very passionate about. So I'm actually currently doing some research for Habitat for Humanity in Kenya. I have been working with a number of microfinance banks in Kenya to design loans that target low-income female customers and enable them to build or improve their home. And with our research, we're trying to look at what impact this has had on their women's lives and well-being and sort of how it's transformed them. And it's been really fascinating. Women who are able to build a house here in their local communities are really affected. So it's allowed a number of them to become community leaders or even enter local government. And it's also really improved their lives. For example, now they're able to collect rainwater using the roof of the house, whereas before they were spending long hours fetching water from the well or the river, or, you know, they've installed solar lighting in their house, so their children are able to do homework even in the evening. So it's been really quite impactful, and it's a pleasure, like, hearing stories of how people's lives have changed for the better.
That's amazing. You also started a social enterprise called Sauti. Can you tell me more about what does it do and how did the idea come to life?
Yeah, so I had, at that time when I started Sauti, it's been about 4 years, I think now, I was doing research on behalf of an organization called Trademark East Africa on cross-border trade in Uganda and Kenya. And about 80% of cross-border trade in East Africa in general is done by women. So it's a very female-dominated sector. And these are mostly low-income women who, you know, cross the border every day with goods and sell them in the local market. However, many of them are not aware of their rights and the required customs procedures and documentation. It can make them very vulnerable to corruption and harassment. And they also even sometimes end up using smuggling routes, even though they are technically permitted to trade freely under the East African Common Market Protocol. The East African community is a regional economic community. It's not as advanced as the EU, but the objective of it are very much to, you know, become like the EU. And technically, all of this trade can happen, you know, tariff-free between Kenya and Uganda. But a lot of these women didn't know about it, and they also lacked information on market prices and opportunities that made it difficult for them to negotiate with buyers and suppliers, and they would often end up being cheated. So I think just listening to their issues kind of inspiration struck. Most of these women have mobile phones. Mobile phone ownership is really prevalent in Kenya, even if they're very simple mobile phones. So my co-founder's name is Lance Haley. We developed a mobile-based solution that essentially allows these cross-border traders to access verified real-time information on things like border procedures, taxes they have to pay, prices of commonly traded products, and exchange rates. All of this information allows them to trade much more safely and profitably because at the moment, currently, they have the right information at hand and they can access it anytime on their phone. So I think it's, from what we've heard from them, it's been very empowering. A lot of them have, you know, been able to access new markets or opportunities that they didn't know about and really grow their businesses.
And how many countries are involved in this cross-border trade? How many borders does Saudi cover?
So the East African community is made up of Kenya, Uganda, Tanzania, Rwanda, Burundi, and South Sudan. And South is currently present in Kenya, Uganda, Rwanda, and Tanzania. So we still have a bit to go. But yeah, we hope to cover the whole of the East African community within the next few years. And I think also we see ourselves really expanding beyond the East African communities. Kind of the nature of cross-border trade is very prevalent across Africa. Also in West Africa, it's mostly carried out by women, same in sovereign Africa. So we definitely have appetites to expand to some of the other regions on the continent.
Mm-hmm. And just out of curiosity, how many people use Sauti to access those informations?
So we currently have about 15,000 users, and of those, about 60% are women.
That's amazing. That's a huge number.
Thank you.
You also decided to start something new and to go in a new direction after Sauti. How did your focus change after starting Sauti and why?
Mm-hmm. So I had been working in the aid for trade sector for quite some time, and I think it's quite a traditional area of development, and I was getting a bit frustrated, I guess, with the lack of innovation in the sector and sort of the very rigid approaches to how projects were structured and implemented. So I decided to focus on a different area of development called market systems development, and that's how I joined Market Share Associates, where I currently work. Market Systems Development, or MSD for short, is an approach to development that is quite different from how traditional direct assistance is provided to low-income people. So for example, if your objective is to address malaria, rather than distributing mosquito nets directly and completely disrupting the local market, you would instead try to understand why there's no locally affordable mosquito nets or why people are not buying them. And then based on your findings, essentially try to facilitate shifts in behaviors, either of consumers or local market actors, to increase the demand and supply of the nets. So for example, you might work with a local manufacturer to start producing nets locally at prices that are more affordable to customers. Or you might, on the demand side, you know, run a consumer awareness campaign that educates people on the benefits of using nets, and so that more of them want to buy them. And this approach can really be applied to any sector where we see, you know, that sector is not adequately serving poor people or vulnerable groups like women. So in my work, I've applied it to the agricultural market sector. It can be applied to childcare services. It can be applied to energy markets, almost any value chain, really. Yeah, so that's sort of the new direction I decided to take. And it's been really interesting. And I've also seen sort of a lot of connections between my previous work focusing on trade and this focus more systemic type of approaches to development.
So is there any example you could give us about one of your latest projects and the focus it had?
Yeah, sure. So last year I carried out a gender assessment of Kakuma refugee camp. This is the second largest refugee camp in Kenya. And we carried out the gender assessment on behalf of the International Finance Corporation, which is essentially trying to incentivize private sector investment in the camp. So that camp has been around for 20 years. There's, you know, generations of people who have been born there and all they know is living in that camp. And it just cannot be sustained long term by humanitarian assistance. And so the IFC is trying to incentivize the private sector to come in and invest, either in terms of providing goods and services to the refugees that they can buy, or in terms of creating jobs that the refugees and the host population, the Turkana people, are able to pick up. So we carried out the gender assessment to essentially inform the design of this new investment fund and make sure that women were not left behind and were able to actively benefit from the opportunities that this fund would create. And one of the interesting things, for example, we found is that, you know, women were not very active in the labor force. And a big reason for it was the lack of childcare services. So a large percentage of the women in the camp have children below the age of two, but they have nowhere to leave them. And of course, you know, due to some of the mental trauma and the physical trauma they've gone through, many of them have escaped war in South Sudan. And just the general kind of maybe insecurity in the camp, they're not comfortable leaving their children alone at home. So that was one of the kind of key recommendations we were able to make to the IFC. So that is now one of the areas they're looking at really investing in, bringing private sector to provide daycare facilities for children below the age of two or three who are not able to go to the publicly provided school. So yes, I think that is sort of an example, you know, of looking at it from a market systems perspective, you know, rather than just say, okay, these women daycare facilities, we're not trying to provide them ourselves. We're trying to see how can the private sector enter and provide provide these daycare facilities? And what is the both social and commercial case for the private sector to do that those investments can be long-term and can be sustainable?
That's amazing. And maybe a very honest question. Do you feel like you see the impact after you, for example, do the assessment and you design the proposed solution? Do you see things moving forward in a pace that you feel happy about?
Yeah, I think that is one positive example. It doesn't always happen like that. I think sometimes, you know, especially when you're a consultant, you can feel like you're doing research and drafting a report and it kind of just goes out and you don't even know if it's read or if anyone is going to take your recommendations forward. I think to an extent, I think things, you know, do happen slowly sometimes in the development sector. And I think we also have to be patient. Like, change takes a very long time. And I think actually a very short-term approach to providing development assistance or humanitarian aid is what has hurt the sector in the past. And to develop local markets, for example, as the IFC is trying to do in Kakuma, it takes 5-10 years. I do see it, but of course, yes, I would like to see it faster, but I'm always reminding myself to be patient and that change takes time.
Absolutely. Slowly but surely getting there, and it's a long run. And that's maybe why you are there for 5 years to actually see the impact in the local economy.
Yes. I think even when I was starting Saudi, we had so many ambitious plans, and of course you have investors who are really pushing you to implement and pilot and test, but simple things like getting your business registration done or getting any kind of permission from the government, getting communities on board with your activities, it takes time. So I think being part of Saudi or starting Saudi really taught me a lot of patience.
And how's life in Kenya, both from a personal and professional perspective for you?
And I think Kenya is just an absolutely beautiful country. There's just so much, you know, nature and wildlife to explore. So many parts of Kenya, especially in the north, are still really wild. So you can do a road trip there and kind of camp in the wilderness and you feel a bit like an explorer. So getting to do that is amazing, getting to do that on the weekend or when taking vacation. From a professional perspective, I mean, there's a really big startup scene here in Kenya. It's known as the Silicon Savannah. So it's been really fun to be part of that and meet so many passionate and talented entrepreneurs doing awesome things, delivering internet or solar power to like last mile communities far in the desert of Turkana, or working on upskilling and creating job opportunities for youth in the slums in Nairobi. So I think being part of that is just so energizing. Almost anyone you meet at a party or a networking event is doing something amazing for their work. It's a really inspirational space to be.
If you want to become one of those social entrepreneurs over there, how does it work with development project fundings? What are your tips on getting money for social ventures in East Africa?
So I think we were very lucky with Saudi. When we started, there was a lot of interest. A lot of private and public financing was flowing to the East African region and focusing on, you know, impact investment and investing in social ventures. And because our focus was both on technology and women, we ticked a lot of boxes in terms of what funders were asking for. We were able to get some initial funding. It was like a very small prize, I think $10,000 from DPRIZE, which is actually an excellent fund for early stage social ventures focused on developing countries. That sort of got us rolling and helped us get started, you know, and once we had that little funding and were able to do some initial prototyping and piloting, it was much easier to apply for more funding. So yeah, I think one recommendation is definitely look for kind of small grants that are very applicable for like early stage companies that can just help you get started and help you test some of ideas. Because I think often as an entrepreneur, you have an idea, you know, you see a market gap and you think your product or service will fit, but that might not be the case and you really need to do a lot of testing. I think showing resilience is really important. As mentioned, starting a business in East Africa, or actually I would say anywhere in the world, is not easy. And there will be so many obstacles and challenges that will come across your path. So showing to potential investors that you can handle these and that you have the expertise in your team to handle these is really important. And then I think finally, like storytelling. Investors, of course, are interested in commercial returns and the sustainability of your business, but it's actually the story that you tell, you know, on how your product or service will change lives or transform a certain industry. That is what they will remember. And yeah, I think that is what will actually bring the funds in.
Mm-hmm. And is there anything that you find really specific for that region compared to maybe like global investment funds?
I don't think I can for sure say, because I haven't really had the same exposure to global investment funds. What I do think is very important is, you know, having a strong local team. I think it's a bit dangerous coming here as an expat and just starting a business and then staffing it with other foreigners. I think you 100% need local expertise. It's also a great way to build local capacity. You know, I don't plan to be Kenya for the next 5 years. Building up our team so that they're able to take over the long term is really important, and I think it's increasingly something investors are also looking to see.
Awesome. Thank you so much for sharing. Julia, what were maybe the biggest challenges that you face, not only coming to Kenya, but also with starting Saudi or with other areas of your professional life?
I think definitely when starting Saudi, it was challenging for me. I think something I recognized quite early on is that particularly strong, nor do I enjoy sort of operations. I'm very much an ideas and kind of vision person, and I enjoy getting those ideas started, but getting bogged down in sort of the details, I found, yeah, very difficult. And I think also, you know, as a young entrepreneur and as a woman, definitely face a lot of issues around imposter, sort of, am I the right person to be doing this, and a lot of doubt. And I think that's something that is not talked about so openly in the kind of startup scene, you know, kind of the more mental health issues. Yeah, the struggles that come with being an entrepreneur. And often you go to pitch events and you see everyone projecting so much confidence and so much self-belief. And I think I found that quite hard because I didn't feel necessarily that way. But obviously, it's something you have to do for investors and even for your team. So I think that is something like I wish was talked about a bit more openly in the startup scene. And I think it's also particularly for women. I know a lot of female founders in Kenya, and I think it's a common issue that many women face. So I think, yeah, those were some of the challenges I faced. And I think particularly on the operations side, I recognized early on this was not something I enjoyed doing, and it was nothing I would ever be particularly strong at doing. So it was really important to me, you know, to build a really qualified local team that could take on those roles and kind of take Saudi to new levels. Yeah, I think we have done that. We are still a very small team, but I think we're able to do a lot. I mean, being present in 4 countries in East Africa, you know, with such a small team, I think is a testament to that.
Mm. So my next question would be, what is the accomplishment that you're most proud of? You mentioned already, you know, putting together a team, which is an amazing accomplishment, and overcoming the hard starts of starting a social enterprise. But is there anything else that you would like to share?
How Saudi has been able to evolve. You know, when we started, we had a very specific idea about what our business model was and kind of how we would operate. But I think that's changed so much, and we're constantly kind of innovating and thinking creatively about that. So even as we have scaled to other countries, we're constantly like expanding our service offerings. So for example, currently in Kenya, we're developing a WhatsApp version of our platform, as WhatsApp has become, you know, really highly used even by very remote populations. We're also doing a lot of research and consulting work for different organizations. So I think, yeah, always that kind of willingness to try new things has been really important. And I think it's, you know, again, that's part of building a team. I think you really have to instill that culture within the organization where people are always willing to go to new places and don't get really kind of stuck, you know, in the, this is what we were going to do, so this is what we have to do. Rather, we're constantly being innovative and creative. So I think seeing that culture, it's really part of Southeast DNA, that culture. I think all of our team members always thinking about it. So I'm also really proud of that.
Amazing. So adapting the growth mindset and staying flexible throughout the growth. Everything you do, your work sounds really rewarding, but I'm sure it can be also very stressful sometimes. What are some of the self-care activities that keep you personally healthy and happy?
Definitely traveling and hiking. As mentioned before, Kenya is such a beautiful country to explore. Husband and I hiked Mount Kenya earlier this year. It was really exhilarating. It's so challenging physically on your body, but to stand on the second highest mountain in Africa is just an amazing experience. And I think it takes you out of your kind of comfort zone. It takes you out of yourself and actually allows you to see new things about yourself or about the world around you. And I really love that. I'm also quite into yoga and mindfulness practices like meditation. I did a yoga teacher training course last year and continue to build yoga into my daily habits and practices. And I think it's also something that's really helped me cope with some of the stress or expectations I put on myself as a founder or just even a development professional. So yeah, it's been very, very important from a self-care perspective.
You also were and are an expat in first London, now Kenya. How did you and how do you build your network in the foreign countries you live in?
So I think in London, I was very lucky that I was doing my master's at the time. And obviously, it's so much easier to make friends when you're studying and you're with a lot of other young people interested in the same topics as you. I think in Kenya, it's actually been very easy. It's a very welcoming community here through a number of our hobbies. Mine and my husband, we got to meet a lot of people. He's very into climbing. We're both very into hiking. So we met a lot of people at the local climbing gym. And then as mentioned, there's just a really big entrepreneurial space here. And I think everyone that stays is very welcoming and very supportive. People are always interested in collaborating or willing to give you advice. So I think also for exposure to kind of that scene, I've been able to develop a lot of really good friendships.
And how about the language barrier? Do local people speak English?
Yeah, so I mean, I would say for sure Nairobi, majority of people speak English. Obviously, once you get outside of Nairobi, it's trickier. Most people will speak Swahili, which is kind of the common local language across Kenya. But then, of course, there's a lot of different tribes. So in some areas, people will only, especially in remote rural communities, will only speak the local language of their community. In Nairobi, everyone speaks English. I have to admit, I did try to learn Swahili when I first moved here, but just failed miserably, mainly because it's so easy to still get around Nairobi in English. I have developed like a bit of an ear for Swahili, so I think if I'm conducting interviews and I have the translator with me, I can usually pick up on like what is happening in the conversation, but definitely don't know it well enough to hold the conversation myself. Mm. English in Nairobi is perfectly fine.
Awesome. Can you order at least food in Swahili, for example?
That would be challenging. That would actually be challenging.
You'll probably order something else than you want to.
Yeah. Simple things, I probably could. It would be challenging.
I bet. Julia, you took a leap of faith so many times, you know, moving to a totally different culture, but still we can rarely do everything on our own. And there are many people along the way who support us and who help us get where we are today. Who is it and was it in the past for you?
I think in the past, like the development sector was quite male dominated, although I think that is changing very fast. But I think I was very lucky, you know, in the number of the organizations I worked with, that I had bosses and colleagues, both male and female, who really supported my growth and gave me opportunities to really push myself and excel. I'm very grateful because once you get to that level, it's easy to kind of hog the stage, but they really chose to share the stage with me and it has given me access to so many amazing opportunities at a very early stage in my career. Especially in Kenya, I've had the opportunity to work with some amazing female leaders and just seeing their leadership style, which I think is quite different of what we see as de facto leadership style or the very kind of male leadership style, was really instructive, just their ability to be what I would say is like soft and hard at the same time. So they were setting very high standards for the team and expected a lot from their team, but were also able to bring so much empathy and care to the workplace. So I definitely learned a lot from them, something I tried to emulate. And I think also in the early days of Southie, we had some amazing mentors. The Hague Institute for Innovation in Law was long-term kind of funder and supporter of Southie, and they were able to expose us to some amazing mentors, both in their Netherlands-based organizations. So some of them are from Netherlands, but also locally in Kenya, and they really helped us take Southie to new levels.
That's great that you were so lucky to be surrounded by those inspirational people. I was just thinking, when you talked about leadership, what is the most important leadership trait for you personally?
I think it is 100% empathy. It's such an important and such an underrated leadership style, perhaps because we've been a bit used to seeing mostly male leaders. And I think empathy is something that women can really bring to the table as leaders. I'm not saying men can't be empathetic. My husband, he's an amazing leader and manager, very empathetic. But I think it's a trait you see more in women. And it's just so important, whether relating with your employees or relating with your business partners or investors, beneficiaries of whatever you're doing. I think it's a really vital trait that is very underrated.
Yeah, I totally agree with you. Julia, looking now towards more the future, what is next for you?
From professional perspective, obviously COVID has kind of affected my work quite a bit. Normally, my work involves a lot of travel to different countries, and the projects that we work with, obviously, that has come to a stop. So I think figuring out how to do what I do in this kind of new reality is one challenge. But it's also been very interesting. For example, a lot of the research we normally do is done in person. So figuring out how that can be done over the phone or through other means, especially with communities which are kind of not connected to the internet or might not even have phones, has been really interesting. So that's kind of immediate challenge. For Saudi, we are in the process of starting up some very interesting projects here in Kenya. We are, as mentioned, expanding our offering. So developing a WhatsApp version of our platform and then also adding some other useful information to the information services that we offer on our platform. And we're also in the process of extending to Burundi. So continuing kind of our growth across the East African region. Yeah, I think those are kind of immediate things. Yeah, and just trying to stay positive, trying to just deal with the current reality. It's been a while, for example, since I've seen my family and I really miss them. They actually live in the Czech Republic in Prague. Mm. And so, yeah, that not being able to see them for a long time has been difficult, but just adjusting to that reality and hoping I'll see them in the near future.
I really do hope so for you, that you might be able to come to Prague soon to see your family, to visit us, to come to one of our FemPalat events. I'd be so happy to meet you in person.
Definitely, I would love that.
Julia, where can our listeners learn more about the projects you do and connect with you?
Definitely LinkedIn is a good place. My name is Julia Hackspiel, so you can find me there, H-A-K-S-P-I-E-L. Or on Twitter, my username is Julia K-L-H-R. Although I'm much more active, I would say, on LinkedIn than Twitter. But I do sometimes post.
All right, thank you. I'll add it to the podcast notes so that we can find you straight away. And I'd like to wrap up our interview with this question that I ask our guests to get this uplifting vibe of other women around us. And I would like to ask, what women in your surrounding do you admire and you would like to give them a shout out in this episode?
So I think a very special woman I admire in my surrounding is Mary Rowlett, who's the CEO of Saudi, and she sort of replaced me when I stepped down from Saudi in my CEO role. Of course, I'm still involved very much in the strategic direction of Saudi. And I think she just inspires me every day, kind of how she deals with the challenges that, you know, you experience as a growing business, and kind of the new level of energy and passion she's been able to bring to the organization. It has been really, really, yeah, really fun to work with, and has allowed us to really grow to new levels. I wanted to give her a shout out because I think she's been a really key component of Saudi's success in the past 2 years.
I hope Mary listens and knows that she's a source of inspiration for you every day. And I would like to say thank you to you for giving inspiration to us in this episode of our FemPalat podcast. It makes me so happy to see that there are people in the world who do those amazing things to improve the local communities. So thank you for accepting the invite and connecting with me from Kenya.
Thank you so much for having me. It was really fun and really a pleasure speaking with you. And definitely look forward to hearing more from FemPalat.
Looking forward to meeting you soon. Have a nice day.
Thanks, you too.
And that's a wrap. But the fun doesn't have to stop here. If you have any questions, guest suggestions, or feedback, shoot us an email to podcast@fempalat.com. To learn more about our community, head over right now to FemPalat Instagram or Facebook and get involved. Thank you for listening and join us in 2 weeks for the next episode of On Air, a podcast by FemPalat.